between them. In the business of preparation and equipment he soon lost himself, and even his grief at parting from Ada, who remained in Hertfordshire, while he, Mr. Jarndyce, and I went up to London for a week. He remembered her by fits and starts, even with bursts of tears, and at such times would confide to me the heaviest self-reproaches. But in a few minutes he would recklessly conjure up some undefinable means by which they were both to be made rich and happy for ever, and would become as gay as possible. It was a busy time, and I trotted about with him all day long, buying a variety of things of which he stood in need. Of the things he would have bought if he had been left to his own ways, I say nothing. He was perfectly confidential with me, and often talked so sensibly and feelingly about his faults and his vigorous resolutions, and dwelt so much upon the encouragement he derived from these conversations, that I could never have been tired if I had tried. There used, in that week, to come backward and forward to our lodging to fence with Richard, a person who had formerly been a cavalry soldier. He was a fine, bluff-looking man, of a frank, free bearing, with whom Richard had practised for some months. I heard so much about him, not only from Richard, but from my guardian too, that I was purposely in the room with my work one morning after breakfast when he came.
"Good morning, Mr. George," said my guardian, who happened to be alone with me. "Mr. Carstone will be here directly. Meanwhile, Miss Summerson is very happy to see you, I know. Sit down."
He sat down, a little disconcerted by my presence, I thought, and without looking at me drew his heavy, sunburnt hand across and across his upper lip.
"You are as punctual as the sun," said Mr. Jarndyce.
"Military time, sir," he replied. "Force of habit, a mere habit in me, sir. I'm not at all business-like."
"Yet you have a large establishment, too, I am told," said Mr. Jarndyce.
"Not much of a one, sir. I keep a shooting gallery, but not much of a one."
"What kind of a shot and what kind of a swordsman do you make of Mr. Carstone?" said my guardian.
"Pretty good, sir,"
he replied, folding his arms upon his broad chest and looking very large.
"If Mr. Carstone was to give his full mind to it, he would come out very good."
"But he don't, I suppose," said my guardian.
"He did at first, sir, but not afterwards. Not his full mind. Perhaps he has something else upon it. Some young lady, perhaps."
His bright, dark eyes glanced at me for the first time. "He has not me upon his mind, I assure you, Mr. George," said I, laughing, "though you seem to suspect me." He reddened a little through his brown and made me a trooper's bow.
"No offence, I hope, miss. I am one of the roughs."
"Not at all," said I. "I take it as a compliment." If he had not looked at me before, he looked at me now in three or four quick, successive glances.
"I beg your pardon, sir,"
he said to my guardian, with a manly kind of diffidence,
"but you did me the honour to mention the young lady's name."
"Miss Summerson."
"Miss Summerson,"
he repeated, and looked at me again. "Do you know the name?" I asked.
"No, miss. To my knowledge, I never heard it. I thought I had seen you somewhere."
"I think not," I returned, raising my head from my work to look at him. And there was something so genuine in his speech and manner that I was glad of the opportunity. I remember faces very well.
"So do I, miss,"
he returned, meeting my look with the fullness of his dark eyes and broad forehead.
"Hum! What set me off now upon that?"
His once more reddening through his brown and being disconcerted by his efforts to remember the association brought my guardian to his relief.
"Have you many pupils, Mr. George?"
"They vary in their number, sir. Mostly they're but a small lot to live by."
"And what classes of chance people come to practice at your gallery?"
"All sorts, sir. Natives and foreigners, from gentlemen to apprentices. I've had French women come before now and show themselves dabs at pistol shooting. Mad people out of number, of course, but they go everywhere where the doors stand open."
"People don't come with grudges and schemes of finishing their practice with live targets, I hope?" said my guardian, smiling.
"Not much of that, sir, though that has happened. Mostly they come for skill, or idleness, six of one and half a dozen of the other." "I beg your pardon,"
said Mr. George, sitting stiffly upright and squaring an elbow on each knee.
"But I believe you're a chancery suitor, if I have heard correct."
"I'm sorry to say I am."
"I've had one of your compatriots in my time, sir."
"A chancery suitor?" returned my guardian. "How was that?"
While the man was so badgered and worried and tortured by being knocked about from post to pillar and from pillar to post, said Mr. George, that he got out of sorts. I don't believe he had any idea of taking aim at anybody, but he was in that condition of resentment and violence that he would come and pay for 50 shots and fire away till he was red hot. One day I said to him, when there was nobody by, and he'd been talking to me angrily about his wrongs, "If this practice is a safety valve, comrade, well and good, but I don't altogether like your being so bent upon it in your present state of mind. I'd rather you took to something else." I was on my guard for a blow, he was that passionate, but he received it in very good part and left off directly. We shook hands and struck up a sort of friendship.
"What was that man?" asked my guardian, in a new tone of interest.
"Why, he began by being a small Shropshire farmer, before they made a baited bull of him," said Mr. George.
"Was his name Gridley?"
"It was, sir."
Mr. George directed another succession of quick, bright glances at me, as my guardian and I exchanged a word or two of surprise at the coincidence, and I therefore explained to him how we knew the name. He made me another of his soldierly bows in acknowledgment of what he called my condescension.
"I don't know," he said as he looked at me, "what it is that sets me off again, but, bosh, what's my head running against?"
He passed one of his heavy hands over his crisp, dark hair, as if to sweep the broken thoughts out of his mind, and sat a little forward with one arm akimbo and the other resting on his leg, looking in a brown study at the ground.
"I'm sorry to learn that the same state of mind has got this Gridley into new troubles, and that he is in hiding," said my guardian.
"So I am told, sir,"
returned Mr. George, still musing and looking on the ground.
"So I am told."
"You don't know where?"
"No, sir,"
returned the trooper, lifting up his eyes and coming out of his reverie.
"Can't say anything about him. He will be worn out soon, I expect. He may file a strong man's heart away for a good many years, but it will tell all of a sudden at last."
Richard's entrance stopped the conversation. Mr. George rose, made me another of his soldierly bows, wished my guardian a good day, and strode heavily out of the room. This was the morning of the day appointed for Richard's departure. We had no more purchases to make now. I had completed all his packing early in the afternoon, and our time was disengaged until night, when he was to go to Liverpool for Holyhead. Jarndyce and Jarndyce being again expected to come on that day, Richard proposed to me that we should go down to the court and hear what passed. As it was his last day and he was eager to go, and I had never been there, I gave my consent, and we walked down to Westminster, where the court was then sitting. We beguiled the way with arrangements concerning the letters that Richard was to write to me, and the letters that I was to write to him, and with a great many hopeful projects. My guardian knew where we were going, and therefore was not with us. When we came to the court, there was the Lord Chancellor, the same whom I had seen in his private room in Lincoln's Inn, sitting in great state and gravity on the bench, with a mace and seals on a red table below him, and an immense flat nosegay like a little garden, which scented the whole court. Below the table again was a long row of solicitors, with bundles of papers on the matting at their feet, and then there were the gentlemen of the bar in wigs and gowns, some awake and some asleep, and one talking, and nobody paying much attention to what he said. The Lord Chancellor leaned back in his very easy chair, with his elbow on the cushioned arm and his forehead resting on his hand. Some of those who were present dozed, some read the newspapers, some walked about or whispered in groups. All seemed perfectly at their ease, by no means in a hurry, very unconcerned and extremely comfortable. To see everything going on so smoothly, and to think of the roughness of the suitors' lives and deaths, to see all that full dress and ceremony, and to think of the waste and want and beggared misery it represented, to consider that while the sickness of hope deferred was raging in so many hearts, this polite show went calmly on from day to day and year to year in such good order and composure. To behold the Lord Chancellor, and the whole array of practitioners under him, looking at one another and at the spectators, as if nobody had ever heard that all over England the name in which they were assembled was a bitter jest, was held in universal horror, contempt, and indignation, was known for something so flagrant and bad that little short of a miracle could bring any good out of it to anyone. This was so curious and self-contradictory to me, who had no experience of it, that it was at first incredible, and I could not comprehend it. I sat where Richard put me, and tried to listen and looked about me, but there seemed to be no reality in the whole scene, except poor little Miss Flight, the madwoman, standing on a bench and nodding at it. Miss Flight soon espied us and came to where we sat. She gave me a gracious welcome to her domain and indicated, with much gratification and pride, its principal attractions. Mr. Kenge also came to speak to us and did the honours of the place in much the same way, with the bland modesty of a proprietor. It was not a very good day for a visit, he said. He would have preferred the first day of term, but it was imposing. It was imposing. When we had been there half an hour or so, the case in progress, if I may use a phrase so ridiculous in such a connection, seemed to die out of its own vapidity, without coming or being by anybody expected to come to any result. The Lord Chancellor then threw down a bundle of papers from his desk to the gentleman below him, and somebody said,
"Jarndyce and Jarndyce!"
Upon this there was a buzz, and a laugh, and a general withdrawal of the bystanders, and a bringing in of great heaps and piles and bags full of papers. I think it came on, "For further directions," about some bill of costs, to the best of my understanding, which was confused enough, but I counted 23 gentlemen in wigs who said they were in it, and none of them appeared to understand it much better than I. They chatted about it with Lord Chancellor, and contradicted, and explained among themselves, and some of them said it was this way, and some of them said it was that way, and some of them jocosely proposed to read huge volumes of affidavits, and there was more buzzing and laughing, and everybody concerned was in a state of idle entertainment, and nothing could be made of it by anybody. After an hour or so of this, and a good many speeches being begun and cut short, it was "referred back for the present," as Mr. Kenge said, and the papers were bundled up again before the clerks had finished bringing them in. I glanced at Richard on the termination of these hopeless proceedings, and was shocked to see the worn look of his handsome young face. "It can't last for ever, Dame Durden. Better luck next time," was all he said. I had seen Mr. Guppy bringing in papers and arranging them for Mr. Kenge, and he had seen me and made me a forlorn bow, which rendered me desirous to get out of the court. Richard had given me his arm and was taking me away when Mr. Guppy came up.
"I beg your pardon, Mr. Carstone," said he in a whisper, "and Miss Summerson's also, but there's a lady here, a friend of mine, who knows her and wishes to have the pleasure of shaking hands."
As he spoke, I saw before me, as if she had started into bodily shape from my remembrance, Mrs. Rachel of my godmother's house.
"How do you do, Esther?" said she. "Do you recollect me?"
I gave her my hand and told her yes, and that she was very little altered.
"I wonder you remember those times, Esther," she returned with her old asperity. "They are changed now. Well, I'm glad to see you, and glad you are not too proud to know me."
But indeed she seemed disappointed that I was not.
"Proud, Mrs. Rachel," I remonstrated. "I am married, Esther," she returned, coldly correcting me, "and am Mrs. Chadband. Well, I wish you good day, and I hope you'll do well."
Mr. Guppy, who had been attentive to this short dialogue, heaved a sigh in my ear and elbowed his own and Mrs. Rachel's way through the confused little crowd of people coming in and going out, which we were in the midst of, and which the change in the business had brought together. Richard and I were making our way through it, and I was yet in the first chill of the late unexpected recognition, when I saw, coming towards us, but not seeing us, no less a person than Mr. George. He made nothing of the people about him as he tramped on, staring over their heads into the body of the court.
"George,"
said Richard, as I called his attention to him.
"You are well met, sir," he returned. "And you, miss. Could you point a person out for me, I want? I don't understand these places."
Turning, as he spoke, and making an easy way for us, he stopped when we were out of the press in a corner behind a great red curtain.
"There's a little cracked old woman," he began, "that—"
I put up my finger, for Miss Flight was close by me, having kept beside me all the time, and having called the attention of several of her legal acquaintance to me, as I had overheard to my confusion, by whispering in their ears,
"Hush, Fitz Jarndyce on my left."
"Hem!"
said Mr. George.
"You remember, miss, that we passed some conversation on a certain man this morning, Gridley?"
in a low whisper behind his hand.
"Yes,"
said I.
"He is hiding at my place. I couldn't mention it, hadn't his authority. He is on his last march, miss, and has a whim to see her. He says they can feel for one another, and she has been almost as good as a friend to him here. I came down to look for her, for when I sat by Gridley this afternoon I seemed to hear the roll of the muffled drums.
"Shall I tell her?" said I.
"Would you be so good?"
he returned with a glance of something like apprehension at Miss Flight.
"It's a providence I met you, miss. I doubt if I should have known how to get on with that lady."
And he put one hand in his breast, and stood upright in a martial attitude, as I informed little Miss Flight, in her ear, of the purport of his kind errand.
"My angry friend from Shropshire, almost as celebrated as myself," she exclaimed. "Now, really, my dear, I will wait upon him with the greatest pleasure."
"He's living concealed at Mr. George's," said I. "Hush, this is Mr. George."
"Indeed," returned Miss Flight. "Very proud to have the honour. A military man, my dear. You know, a perfect general," she whispered to me.
Poor Miss Flight deemed it necessary to be so courtly and polite as a mark of her respect for the army, and to curtsy so very often that it was no easy matter to get her out of the court. When this was at last done, and addressing Mr. George as General, she gave him her arm, to the great entertainment of some idlers who were looking on. He was so discomposed, and begged me so respectfully,
"not to desert him,"
that I could not make up my mind to do it, especially as Miss Flight was always tractable with me, and as she too said,
"Fitz Jarndyce, my dear, you will accompany us, of course."
As Richard seemed quite willing, and even anxious that we should see them safely to their destination, we agreed to do so. And as Mr. George informed us that Gridley's mind had run on Mr. Jarndyce all the afternoon, after hearing of their interview in the morning, I wrote a hasty note in pencil to my guardian to say where we were gone and why. Mr. George sealed it at a coffee-house, that it might lead to no discovery, and we sent it off by a ticket-porter. We then took a hackney-coach and drove away to the neighbourhood of Leicester Square. We walked through some narrow courts, for which Mr. George apologised, and soon came to the shooting-gallery, the door of which was closed. As we pulled a bell-handle which hung by a chain to the door-post, a very respectable old gentleman with grey hair, wearing spectacles and dressed in a black spencer and gaiters and a broad-brimmed hat and carrying a large gold-headed cane, addressed him.
"I ask your pardon, my good friend," said he, "but is this George's shooting-gallery?"
"It is, sir,"
returned Mr. George, glancing up at the great letters in which that inscription was painted on the whitewashed wall.
"Oh, to be sure," said the old gentleman, following his eyes. "Thank you. Have you rung the bell?"
"My name is George, sir, and I have rung the bell."
"Oh, indeed," said the old gentleman. "Your name is George. Then I am here as soon as you see. You came for me, no doubt?"
"No, sir, you have the advantage of me."
"Oh, indeed," said the old gentleman. "Then it was your young man who came for me. I am a physician and was requested 5 minutes ago to come and visit a sick man at George's shooting gallery."
"The muffled drums," said Mr. George,
turning to Richard and me and gravely shaking his head.
"It's quite correct, sir. Will you please to walk in?"
The door being at that moment opened by a very singular-looking little man in a green baize cap and apron, whose face and hands and dress were blackened all over, we passed along a dreary passage into a large building with bare brick walls, where there were targets and guns and swords and other things of that kind. When we had all arrived here, the physician stopped, and taking off his hat, appeared to vanish by magic, and to leave another and quite a different man in his place.
"Now, looky here, George,"
said the man, turning quickly round upon him and tapping him on the breast with a large forefinger. "You know me, and I know you. You're a man of the world, and I'm a man of the world. My name's Bucket, as you are aware, and I've got a peace warrant against Gridley. You've kept him out of the way a long time, and you have been artful in it, and it does you credit."
Mr. George, looking hard at him, bit his lip and shook his head.
"Now, George," said the other, keeping close to him, "you're a sensible man and a well-conducted man. That's what you are, beyond a doubt. And mind you, I don't talk to you as a common character, because you have served your country, and you know that when duty calls, we must obey. Consequently, you're very far from wanting to give trouble. If I required assistance, you'd assist me. That's what you'd do. Phil Squad, don't you go a-sidling round the gallery like that?"
The dirty little man was shuffling about with his shoulder against the wall and his eyes on the intruder in a manner that looked threatening.
"Because I know you and won't have it."
"Phil!"
said Mr. George.
"Yes, Governor."
"Be quiet!"
The little man, with a low growl, stood still.
"Ladies and gentlemen," said Mr. Bucket, "you'll excuse anything that may appear to be disagreeable in this, for my name's Inspector Bucket of the Detective, and I have a duty to perform. "George, I know where my man is, because I was on the roof last night and saw him through the skylight, and you along with him. He's in there, you know," pointing. "That's where he is, on a sofa. Now I must see my man, and I must tell my man to consider himself in custody. But you know me, and you know I don't want to take any uncomfortable measures. You give me your word, as from one man to another, and an old soldier, mind you, likewise, that it's honourable between us two, and I'll accommodate you to the utmost of my power."
"I give it," was the reply. "But it wasn't handsome in you, Mr. Bucket."
"Gammon, George. Not handsome," said Mr. Bucket, tapping him on his broad breast again and shaking hands with him. "I don't say it wasn't handsome in you to keep my man so close, do I? Be equally good-tempered to me, old boy. Old William Tell, old Shaw, the Life Guardsman. Why, he's a model of the whole British Army in himself, ladies and gentlemen. I'll give a £50 note to be such a figure of a man."
The affair being brought to this head, Mr. George, after a little consideration, proposed to go in first to his comrade, as he called him, taking Miss Flight with him. Mr. Bucket agreeing, they went away to the further end of the gallery, leaving us sitting and standing by a table covered with guns. Mr. Bucket took this opportunity of entering into a little light conversation, asking me if I were afraid of firearms, as most young ladies were, asking Richard if he were a good shot, asking Phil Squad which he considered the best of those rifles, and what it might be worth first hand, telling him in return that it was a pity he ever gave way to his temper, for he was naturally so amiable that he might have been a young woman and making himself generally agreeable. After a time he followed us to the further end of the gallery, and Richard and I were going quietly away when Mr. George came after us. He said that if we had no objection to see his comrade, he would take a visit from us very kindly. The words had hardly pressed his lips when the bell was rung and my guardian appeared.
"On the chance," he slightly observed, "of being able to do any little thing for a poor fellow involved in the same misfortune as himself."
We all four went back together and went into the place where Gridley was. It was a bare room, partitioned off from the gallery with unpainted wood. As the screening was not more than 8 or 10 feet high, and only enclosed the sides, not the top, the rafters of the high gallery roof were overhead, and the skylight through which Mr. Bucket had looked down. The sun was low, near setting, and its light came redly in above, without descending to the ground. Upon a plain canvas-covered sofa lay the man from Shropshire, dressed much as we had seen him last, but so changed that at first I recognised no likeness in his colourless face to what I recollected. He had been still writing in his hiding-place, and still dwelling on his grievances hour after hour. A table and some shelves were covered with manuscript papers, and with worn pens, and a medley of such tokens. Touchingly and awfully drawn together, he and the little mad woman were side by side, and as it were, alone. She sat on a chair holding his hand, and none of us went close to them. His voice had faded with the old expression of his face, with his strength, with his anger, with his resistance to the wrongs that had at last subdued him. The faintest shadow of an object full of form and colour is such a picture of it as he was of the man from Shropshire whom we had spoken with before. He inclined his head to Richard and me and spoke to my guardian.
"Mr. Jarndyce, that is very kind of you to come to see me. I'm not long to be seen, I think."
"I'm very glad to take your hand, sir. You are a good man, superior to injustice, and God knows I honour you."
They shook hands earnestly, and my guardian said some words of comfort to him.
"It may seem strange to you, sir," returned Gridley. "I should not have liked to see you if this had been the first time of our meeting. But you know I made a fight for it. You know I stood up with my single hand against them all. You know I told them the truth to the last, and told them what they were, and what they had done to me. So don't mind your seeing me, this wreck."
"You have been courageous with them many and many a time," returned my guardian.
"Sir, I have been," with a faint smile. "I told you what would come of it when I ceased to be so, and see here. Look at us. Look at us."
He drew the hand Miss Flight held through her arm, and brought her something nearer to him.
"This ends it. Of all my old associations, of all my old pursuits and hopes, of all the living and the dead world, this one poor soul alone comes natural to me, and I am fit for. There is a tie of many suffering years between us two, and it is the only tie I ever had on earth that Chancery has not broken."
"Accept my blessing, Gridley," said Miss Flight in tears. "Accept my blessing. I thought boastfully that they never could break my heart, Mr. Jarndyce. I was resolved that they should not. I did believe that I could and would charge them with being the mockery they were until I died of some bodily disorder. But I am worn out. How long I have been wearing out, I don't know. I seemed to break down in an hour. I hope they may never come to hear of it. I hope everybody here will lead them to believe that I died defying them, consistently and perseveringly as I did through so many years. Here Mr. Bucket, who was sitting in a corner by the door, good-naturedly offered such consolation as he could administer.
"Come, come," he said from his corner. "Don't go on in that way, Mr. Gridley. You're only a little low. We're all of us a little low sometimes. I am. Hold up, hold up. You'll lose your temper with the whole round of 'em again and again, and I shall take you on a score of warrants yet, if I have luck."
He only shook his head.
"Don't shake your head," said Mr. Bucket. "Nod it. That's what I want to see you do. Why, Lord bless your soul, what times we've had together! Haven't I seen you in the Fleet over and over again for contempt? Haven't I come into court 20 afternoons for no other purpose than to see you pin the Chancellor like a bulldog? Don't you remember when you first began to threaten the lawyers, and the peace was sworn against you 2 or 3 times a week? Ask the little old lady there. She has been always present. Hold up, Mr. Gridley. Hold up, sir."
"What are you going to do about him?"
asked George, in a low voice.
"I don't know yet," said Bucket, in the same tone.
Then, resuming his encouragement, he pursued aloud, "Worn out, Mr. Gridley? After dodging me for all these weeks, and forcing me to climb the roof here like a tomcat, and to come to see you as a doctor? That ain't like being worn out.
I should think not. Now, I tell you what you want. You want excitement, you know, to keep you up. That's what you want. You're used to it, and you can't do without it. I couldn't myself.
Very well, then. Here's this warrant got by Mr. Tulkinghorn of Lincoln's Inn Fields, and backed into 6 counties since. What do you say to coming along with me, upon this warrant, and having a good angry argument before the magistrates? It'll do you good. It'll freshen you up, and get you into training for another turn at the Chancellor."
"Give in?
Why, I'm surprised to hear a man of your energy talk of giving in. You mustn't do that. You're half the fun of the fair in the Court of Chancery. George, you lend Mr. Gridley a hand, and let's see now whether he won't be better up than down."
"He is very weak,"
said the trooper in a low voice.
"Is he?" returned Bucket anxiously. "I only want to rouse him. I don't like to see an old acquaintance giving in like this. It would cheer him up more than anything if I could make him a little waxy with me. He's welcome to drop into me right and left if he likes. I shall never take advantage of it."
The roof rang with a scream from Miss Flight, which still rings in my ears.
"Oh, no, Gridley!"
she cried, as he fell heavily and calmly back from before her.
"Not without my blessing, after so many years!"
The sun was down. The light had gradually stolen from the roof, and the shadow had crept upward. But to me, the shadow of that pair, one living and one dead, fell heavier on Richard's departure than the darkness of the darkest night. And through Richard's farewell words I heard it echoed. "Of all my old associations, of all my old pursuits and hopes, of all the living and the dead world, this one poor soul alone comes natural to me, and I am fit for. There is a tie of many suffering years between us two, and it is the only tie I ever had on earth that Chancery has not broken." Chapter 25. Mrs. Snagsby sees it all. There is disquietude in Cook's Court, Cursitor Street. Black suspicion hides in that peaceful region. The mass of Cook's courtiers are in their usual state of mind, no better and no worse. But Mr. Snagsby is changed, and his little woman knows it. For Tom Orlone's and Lincoln's Inn Fields persist in harnessing themselves, a pair of ungovernable coursers, to the chariot of Mr. Snagsby's imagination. And Mr. Bucket drives, and the passengers are Joe and Mr. Tulkinghorn, and the complete equipage whirls through the law stationery business at wild speed all round the clock. Even in the little front kitchen where the family meals are taken, it rattles away at a smoking pace from the dinner table when Mr. Snagsby pauses in carving the first slice of the leg of mutton baked with potatoes and stares at the kitchen wall. Mr. Snagsby cannot make out what it is that he has had to do with. Something is wrong somewhere. But what something? What may come of it? To whom? When? And from which unthought of
and unheard-of quarter is the puzzle of his life. His remote impressions of the robes and coronets, the stars and garters that sparkle through the surface dust of Mr. Tulkinghorn's chambers, his veneration for the mysteries presided over by that best and closest of his customers, whom all the inns of court, all Chancery Lane, and all the legal neighbourhood agree to hold in awe. His remembrance of Detective Mr. Bucket, with his forefinger, and his confidential manner, impossible to be evaded or declined, persuade him that he is a party to some dangerous secret, without knowing what it is. And it is the fearful peculiarity of this condition that, at any hour of his daily life, at any opening of the shop door, at any pull of the bell, at any entrance of a messenger, or any delivery of a letter, the secret may take air and fire, explode and blow up. Mr. Bucket only knows whom. For which reason, whenever a man unknown comes into the shop, as many men unknown do, and says, "Is Mr. Snagsby in?" or words to that innocent effect, Mr. Snagsby's heart knocks hard at his guilty breast. He undergoes so much from such inquiries that when they are made by boys, he revenges himself by flipping at their ears over the counter and asking the young dogs what they mean by it and why they can't speak out at once. More impracticable men and boys persist in walking into Mr. Snagsby's sleep and terrifying him with unaccountable questions, so that often when the cock at the little dairy in Cursitor Street breaks out in his usual absurd way about the morning, Mr. Snagsby finds himself in a crisis of nightmare, with his little woman shaking him and saying, "What's the matter with the man?" The little woman herself is not the least item in his difficulty. To know that he is always keeping a secret from her, that he has under all circumstances to conceal and hold fast a tender double tooth, which her sharpness is ever ready to twist out of his head, gives Mr. Snagsby, in her dentistical presence, much of the air of a dog who has a reservation from his master, and will look anywhere rather than meet his eyes. These various signs and tokens, marked by the little woman, are not lost upon her. They impel her to say, "Snagsby has something on his mind," and thus suspicion gets into Cook's Court, Cursitor Street. From suspicion to jealousy. Mrs. Snagsby finds the road as natural and short as from Cook's Court to Chancery Lane, and thus jealousy gets into Cook's Court, Cursitor Street. Once there, and it was always lurking thereabout, it is very active and nimble in Mrs. Snagsby's breast, prompting her to nocturnal examinations of Mr. Snagsby's pockets, to secret perusals of Mr. Snagsby's letters, to private researches in the day-book and ledger, till, cash-box and iron safe, to watchings at windows, listenings behind doors, and a general putting of this and that together by the wrong end. Mrs. Snagsby is so perpetually on the alert that the house becomes ghostly with creaking boards and rustling garments. Apprentices think somebody may have been murdered there in bygone times. Guster holds certain loose atoms of an idea, picked up at Tooting, where they were found floating among the orphans, that there is buried money underneath the cellar, guarded by an old man with a white beard, who cannot get out for 7,000 years because he said the Lord's Prayer backwards. "Who was Nimrod?" Mrs. Snagsby repeatedly inquires of herself. "Who was that lady, that creature? And who is that boy?" Now Nimrod, being as dead as the mighty hunter whose name Mrs. Snagsby has appropriated, and the lady being unproducible, she directs her mental eye for the present with redoubled vigilance to the boy. "And who," quoth Mrs. Snagsby for the 1,001st time, "is that boy? Who is that?" And there Mrs. Snagsby is seized with an inspiration. He has no respect for Mr. Chadband. No, to be sure, and he wouldn't have, of course. Naturally he wouldn't, under those contagious circumstances. He was invited and appointed by Mr. Chadband. Why, Mrs. Snagsby heard it herself with her own ears, to come back and be told where he was to go, to be addressed by Mr. Chadband, and he never came. Why did he never come? Because he was told not to come. Who told him not to come? Who? Ha ha! Mrs. Snagsby sees it all. But happily, and Mrs. Snagsby tightly shakes her head and tightly smiles, that boy was met by Mr. Chadband yesterday in the streets, and that boy, as affording a subject which Mr. Chadband desires to improve for the spiritual delight of a select congregation, was seized by Mr. Chadband and threatened with being delivered over to the police unless he showed the reverend gentleman where he lived, and unless he entered into and fulfilled an undertaking to appear in Cook's Court tomorrow night. To-morrow night, Mrs. Snagsby repeats for mere emphasis, with another tight smile and another tight shake of her head. And tomorrow night that boy will be here. And tomorrow night Mrs. Snagsby will have her eye upon him and upon someone else. And oh, you may walk a long while in your secret ways, says Mrs. Snagsby with haughtiness and scorn, but you can't blind me. Mrs. Snagsby sounds no timbrel in anybody's ears, but holds her purpose quietly and keeps her counsel. Tomorrow comes. The savoury preparations for the oil trade come. The evening comes. Comes Mr. Snagsby in his black coat. Come the Chadbands. Come, when the gorging vessel is replete, the Prentices and Guster to be edified. Comes at last, with his slouching head and his shuffle backward and his shuffle forward, and his shuffle to the right and his shuffle to the left, and his bit of fur cap in his muddy hand, which he picks as if it were some mangy bird he had caught and was plucking before eating raw, Joe, the very, very tough subject Mr. Chadband is to improve. Mrs. Snagsby screws a watchful glance on Joe as he is brought into the little drawing-room by Guster. He looks at Mr. Snagsby the moment he comes in. Aha! Why does he look at Mr. Snagsby? Mr. Snagsby looks at him. Why should he do that, but that Mrs. Snagsby sees it all? Why else should that look pass between them? Why else should Mr. Snagsby be confused and cough a signal cough behind his hand? It is as clear as crystal that Mr. Snagsby is that boy's father.
"Peace, my friends," says Chadband, rising and wiping the oily exudations from his reverend visage. "Peace be with us." "My friends, why with us?" "Because," with his fat smile, "it cannot be against us. Because it must be for us. Because it is not hardening, because it is softening. Because it does not make war like the hawk, but comes home unto us like the dove. Therefore, my friends, peace be with us. My human boy, come forward."
Stretching forth his flabby paw, Mr. Chadband lays the same on Joe's arm and considers where to station him. Joe, very doubtful of his reverend friend's intentions, and not at all clear but that something practical and painful is going to be done to him, mutters,
"You let me alone. I've never said nothing to you. You let me alone."
"No, my young friend," says Chadband smoothly, "I will not let you alone. And why? Because I am a harvest labourer. Because I am a toiler and a moiler. Because you are delivered over unto me, and are become as a precious instrument in my hands. My friends, may I so employ this instrument as to use it to your advantage, to your profit, to your gain, to your welfare, to your enrichment. My young friend, sit upon this stool."
And Joe, apparently possessed by an impression that the reverend gentleman wants to cut his hair, shields his head with both arms, and is got into the required position with great difficulty and every possible manifestation of reluctance. When he is at last adjusted like a lay figure, Mr. Chadband, retiring behind the table, holds up his bear's paw and says,
"My friends!"
This is the signal for a general settlement of the audience. The prentices giggle internally and nudge each other. Guster falls into a staring and vacant state, compounded of a stunned admiration of Mr. Chadband, and pity for the friendless outcast whose condition touches her nearly. Mrs. Snagsby silently lays trains of gunpowder. Mrs. Chadband composes herself grimly by the fire and warms her knees, finding that sensation favourable to the reception of eloquence. It happens that Mr. Chadband has a pulpit habit of fixing some members of his congregation with his eye, and flatly arguing his points with that particular person, who is understood to be expected to be moved to an occasional grunt, groan, gasp, or other audible expression of inward working, which expression of inward working, being echoed by some elderly lady in the next pew, and so communicated like a game of forfeits through a circle of the more fermentable sinners present, serves the purpose of parliamentary cheering, and gets Mr. Chadband's steam up. From mere force of habit, Mr. Chadband, in saying, "My friends," has rested his eye on Mr. Snagsby, and proceeds to make that ill-starred stationer, already sufficiently confused, the immediate recipient of his discourse.
"We have here among us, my friends," says Chadband, "a Gentile and a heathen, a dweller in the tents of Tom All Alones, and a mover on upon the surface of the earth. We have here among us, my friends."
And Mr. Chadband, untwisting the point with his dirty thumbnail, bestows an oily smile on Mr. Snagsby, signifying that he will throw him an argumentative backfall presently, if he be not already down.
"A brother and a boy, devoid of parents, devoid of relations, devoid of flocks and herds, devoid of gold and silver and of precious stones. Now, my friends, why do I say he is devoid of these possessions? Why? Why is he?"
Mr. Chadband states the question as if he were propounding an entirely new riddle of much ingenuity and merit to Mr. Snagsby, and entreating him not to give it up. Mr. Snagsby, greatly perplexed by the mysterious look he received just now from his little woman, at about the period when Mr. Chadband mentioned the word parents, is tempted into modestly remarking, "I don't know, I'm sure, sir." On which interruption Mrs. Chadband glares, and Mrs. Snagsby says, "For shame."
"I hear a voice," says Chadband. "Is it a still small voice, my friends? I fear not, though I fain would hope so."
"Ah!"
from Mrs. Snagsby,
which says, "I don't know." "Then I will tell you why. I say this brother present here among us is devoid of parents, devoid of relations, devoid of flocks and herds, devoid of gold, of silver, and of precious stones, because he is devoid of the light that shines in upon some of us. What is that light? What is it? I ask you, what is that light?"
Mr. Chadband draws back his head and pauses. But Mr. Snagsby is not to be lured on to his destruction again. Mr. Chadband, leaning forward over the table, pierces what he has got to follow directly into Mr. Snagsby with the thumbnail already mentioned.
"It is," says Chadband, "the ray of rays, the sun of suns, the moon of moons, the star of stars. It is the light of Teruth."
Mr. Chadband draws himself up again and looks triumphantly at Mr. Snagsby, as if he would be glad to know how he feels after that.
"Of Teruth," says Mr. Chadband, hitting him again. "Say not to me that it is not the lamp of lamps. I say to you it is. I say to you a million of times over it is. It is. I say to you that I will proclaim it to you, whether you like it or not. Nay, that the less you like it, the more I will proclaim it to you, with a speaking trumpet. I say to you that if you rear yourself against it, you shall fall, you shall be bruised, you shall be battered, you shall be flayed, you shall be smashed."
The present effect of this flight of oratory, much admired for its general power by Mr. Chadband's followers, being not only to make Mr. Chadband unpleasantly warm, but to represent the innocent Mr. Snagsby in the light of a determined enemy to virtue, with a forehead of brass and a heart of adamant, that unfortunate tradesman becomes yet more disconcerted, and is in a very advanced state of low spirits and false position when Mr. Chadband accidentally finishes him.
"My friends,"
he resumes, after dabbing his fat head for some time, and it smokes to such an extent that he seems to light his pocket-handkerchief at it, which smokes too after every dab,
"to pursue the subject we are endeavouring with our lowly gifts to improve, let us in a spirit of love inquire what is that Teruth to which I have alluded. For my young friends,"
suddenly addressing the prentices and Guster to their consternation, "if I am told by the doctor that calomel or castor oil is good for me, I may naturally ask, what is calomel and what is castor oil? I may wish to be informed of that before I dose myself with either or with both.
Now, my young friends, what is this Teruth, then? Firstly, in a spirit of love, what is the common sort of Teruth, the working clothes, the everyday wear, my young friends? Is it deception?"
"Ah-ha!"
from Mrs. Snagsby.
"Is it suppression?"
A shiver in the negative from Mrs. Snagsby.
"Is it reservation?" A shake of the head from Mrs. Snagsby, very long and very tight. "No, my friends, it is neither of these. Neither of these names belongs to it. When this young heathen now among us, who is now, my friends, asleep, a seal of indifference and perdition being set upon his eyelids, but do not wake him, for it is right that I should have to wrestle, and to combat, and to struggle, and to conquer for his sake. When this young hardened heathen told us a story of a cock, and of a bull, and of a lady, and of a sovereign, was that the Terruth? No. Or if it was partly, was it wholly and entirely? No, my friends, no. If Mr. Snagsby could withstand his little woman's look as it enters at his eyes, the windows of his soul, and searches the whole tenement, he were other than the man he is. He cowers and droops. All my juvenile friends, says Chadband, descending to the level of their comprehension with a very obtrusive demonstration in his greasily meek smile of coming a long way downstairs for the purpose. If the master of this house was to go forth into the city and there see an eel, and was to come back and was to call unto him the mistress of this house, and was to say, Sarah, rejoice with me, for I have seen an elephant, would that be Terruth? Mrs. Snagsby in tears. Or put it, my juvenile friends, that he saw an elephant, and returning said, Lo, the city is barren, I have seen but an eel. Would that be Terruth? Mrs. Snagsby, sobbing loudly. Or put it, my juvenile friends, said Chadband, stimulated by the sound, that the unnatural parents of this slumbering heathen, for parents he had, my juvenile friends, beyond a doubt, after casting him forth to the wolves and the vultures and the wild dogs and the young gazelles and the serpents, went back to their dwellings and had their pipes and their pots and their flutings and their dancings and their malt liquors and their butcher's meat and poultry. Would that be Terruth? Mrs. Snagsby replies by delivering herself a prey to spasms, not an unresisting prey, but a crying and a tearing one, so that Cook's Court re-echoes with her shrieks. Finally, becoming cataleptic, she has to be carried up the narrow staircase like a grand piano. After unspeakable suffering, productive of the utmost consternation, she is pronounced, by expresses from the bedroom, free from pain. Though much exhausted, in which state of affairs Mr. Snagsby, trampled and crushed in the pianoforte removal, and extremely timid and feeble, ventures to come out from behind the door in the drawing-room. All this time Joe has been standing on the spot where he woke up, ever picking his cap and putting bits of fur in his mouth. He spits them out with a remorseful air, for he feels that it is in his nature to be an unimprovable reprobate, and that it's no good his trying to keep awake, for he won't never know nothing. Though it may be, Joe, that there is a history so interesting and affecting, even to minds as near the brutes as thine, recording deeds done on this earth for common men, that if the Chadbands, removing their own persons from the light, would but show it thee in simple reverence, would but leave it unimproved, would but regard it as being eloquent enough without their modest aid, it might hold thee awake, and thou might learn from it yet. Joe never heard of any such book. Its compilers and the Reverend Chadband are all one to him, except that he knows the Reverend Chadband, and would rather run away from him for an hour than hear him talk for 5 minutes. "It ain't no good my waiting here no longer," thinks Joe. "Mr. Snagsby ain't going to say nothing to me tonight." And downstairs he shuffles. But downstairs is the charitable Guster, holding by the handrail of the kitchen stairs and warding off a fit, as yet doubtfully, the same having been induced by Mrs. Snagsby's screaming. She has her own supper of bread and cheese to hand to Joe, with whom she ventures to interchange a word or so for the first time. "It's something to eat, poor boy," says Guster.
"Thank ye, ma'am," says Joe.
"Are you hungry?"
"Jist,"
says Joe.
"What's gone of your father and your mother, eh?"
Joe stops in the middle of a bite and looks petrified, for this orphan charge of the Christian saint, whose shrine was at Tooting, has patted him on the shoulder, and it is the first time in his life that any decent hand has been so laid upon him.
"I never knowed nothink about him," says Joe.
"No more did I of mine," cries Guster.
She is repressing symptoms favourable to the fit when she seems to take alarm at something and vanishes down the stairs.
"Joe,"
whispers the law stationer softly as the boy lingers on the step.
"Here I am, Mr. Snagsby."
"I didn't know you were gone. There's another half-crown, Joe. It was quite right of you to say nothing about the lady the other night when we were out together. It will breed trouble. You can't be too quiet, Joe."
"I'm fly, master."
"And so, good night." A ghostly shade, frilled and night-capped, follows the law stationer to the room he came from, and glides higher up. And henceforth he begins, go where he will, to be attended by another shadow than his own, hardly less constant than his own, hardly less quiet than his own, and into whatsoever atmosphere of secrecy his own shadow may pass, let all concerned in the secrecy beware. For the watchful Mrs. Snagsby is there too, bone of his bone, flesh of his flesh, shadow of his shadow. Chapter 26. Sharpshooters. Wintry morning, looking with dull eyes and sallow face upon the neighbourhood of Leicester Square, finds its inhabitants unwilling to get out of bed. Many of them are not early risers at the brightest of times, being birds of night who roost when the sun is high, and are wide awake and keen for prey when the stars shine out. Behind dingy blind and curtain, in upper story and garret, skulking more or less under false names, false hair, false titles, false jewellery, and false histories, a colony of brigands lie in their first sleep. Gentlemen of the Green Baize Road who could discourse from personal experience of foreign galleys and home treadmills. Spies of strong governments that eternally quake with weakness and miserable fear, broken traitors, cowards, bullies, gamesters, shufflers, swindlers, and false witnesses, some not unmarked by the branding iron beneath their dirty braid, all with more cruelty in them than was in Nero, and more crime than is in Newgate. For howsoever bad the devil can be in fustian or smock-frock, and he can be very bad in both, he is a more designing, callous, and intolerable devil when he sticks a pin in his shirt-front, calls himself a gentleman, backs a card or colour, plays a game or so of billiards, and knows a little about bills and promissory notes than in any other form he wears. And in such form Mr. Bucket shall find him, when he will, still pervading the tributary channels of Leicester Square. But the wintry morning wants him not, and wakes him not. It wakes Mr. George of the shooting gallery and his familiar. They arise, roll up, and stow away their mattresses. Mr. George, having shaved himself before a looking-glass of minute proportions, then marches out, bare-headed and bare-chested, to the pump in the little yard, and anon comes back shining with yellow soap, friction, drifting rain, and exceedingly cold water. As he wraps himself upon a large jack-towel, blowing like a military sort of diver just come up, his crisp hair curling tighter and tighter on his sunburnt temples the more he rubs it, so that it looks as if it never could be loosened by any less coercive instrument than an iron rake or a curry-comb. As he rubs and puffs, and polishes and blows, turning his head from side to side, the more conveniently to excoriate his throat, and standing with his body well bent forward to keep the wet from his martial legs, Phil, on his knees, lighting a fire, looks round as if it were enough washing for him to see all that done, and sufficient renovation for one day to take in the superfluous health his master throws off. When Mr. George is dry, he goes to work to brush his head with two hard brushes at once, to that unmerciful degree that Phil, shouldering his way round the gallery in the act of sweeping it, winks with sympathy. This chafing over, the ornamental part of Mr. George's toilet is soon performed. He fills his pipe, lights it, and marches up and down smoking, as his custom is, while Phil, raising a powerful odour of hot rolls and coffee, prepares breakfast. He smokes gravely and marches in slow time. Perhaps this morning's pipe is devoted to the memory of Gridley in his grave.
"And so, Phil,"
says George of the shooting gallery after several turns in silence,
"you were dreaming of the country last night."
Phil, by the by, said as much in a tone of surprise as he scrambled out of bed.
"Yes, Governor."
"What was it like?"
"I hardly know what it was like, Governor," said Phil, considering.
"How did you know it was the country?"
"On account of the grass, I think, and the swans upon it," says Phil, after further consideration.
"What were the swans doing on the grass?"
"They was a-eating of it, I expect," says Phil.
The master resumes his march, and the man resumes his preparation of breakfast. It is not necessarily a lengthened preparation. being limited to the setting forth of very simple breakfast requisites for two, and the broiling of a rasher of bacon at the fire in the rusty grate. But as Phil has to sidle round a considerable part of the gallery for every object he wants, and never brings two objects at once, it takes time, under the circumstances. At length the breakfast is ready. Phil announcing it, Mr. George knocks the ashes out of his pipe on the hob, stands his pipe itself in the chimney corner, and sits down to the meal. When he has helped himself, Phil follows suit, sitting at the extreme end of the little oblong table, and taking his plate on his knees. Either in humility, or to hide his blackened hands, or because it is his natural manner of eating.
"The country!"
says George, plying his knife and fork.
"Why, I suppose, you never clapped your eyes on the country, Phil?"
"I see the marshes once," says Phil, contentedly eating his breakfast.
"What marshes?"
"The marshes, Commander," returns Phil.
"Where are they?"
"I don't know where they are," says Phil. "But I see 'em, Governor. They was flat and misty."
Governor and Commander are interchangeable terms with Phil, expressive of the same respect and deference, and applicable to nobody but Mr. George.
"I was born in the country, Phil."
"Was you indeed, Commander?"
"Yes, and bred there."
Phil elevates his one eyebrow, and after respectfully staring at his master to express interest, swallows a great gulp of coffee, still staring at him.
"There's not a bird's note that I don't know,"
says Mr. George.
"Not many an English leaf or berry that I couldn't name. Not many a tree that I couldn't climb yet, if I was put to it. I was a real country boy once. My good mother lived in the country."
"She must have been a fine old lady, Governor," Phil observes.
"Ay, and not so old either. 35 years ago," says Mr. George. "But I'll wager that at 90 she would be near as upright as me, and near as broad across the shoulders."
"Did she die at 90, Governor?" inquires Phil.
"No, bosh, let her rest in peace, God bless her," says the trooper. "What set me on about country boys and runaways and good-for-nothings?" "Ah, you, to be sure. So you never clapped your eyes upon the country? Marshes and dreams excepted, eh?"
Phil shakes his head.
"You want to see it?"
"No, I don't know as I do, particular," says Phil.
"The town's enough for you, eh?"
"Why, you see, Commander," says Phil, "I ain't acquainted with anything else, and I doubt if I ain't a-getting too old to take to novelties."
"How old are you, Phil?"
asks the trooper, pausing as he conveys his smoking saucer to his lips.
Something with a 8 in it," says Phil. "It can't be 80, nor yet 18. It's betwixt 'em somewheres."
Mr. George, slowly putting down his saucer without tasting its contents, is laughingly beginning,
"Why, what the deuce, Phil?"
when he stops, seeing that Phil is counting on his dirty fingers.
"I was just 8, says Phil, "agreeable to the parish calculation when I went with a tinker. I was sent on a errand, and I see him a-sitting under a old building, with a fire all to himself, very comfortable, and he says, 'Would you like to come along o' me, my man?' I says, 'Yes,' and him and me and the fire goes home to Clerkenwell together. That was April Fool Day. I was able to count up to 10. And when April Fool Day come around again, I says to myself, 'Now, old chap, you're 1 and an 8 in it.' April Fool Day after that, I says, 'Now, old chap, you're 2 and a 8 in it.' In course of time, I come to 10 and a 8 in it, 2 10s and a 8 in it. When it got so high, it got the upper hand of me. But this is how I always know there's a 8 in it."
"Ah,"
says Mr. George, resuming his breakfast.
"Where's the tinker?"
"Drink put him in the hospital, Governor, and the hospital put him in a glass case, I have heard," Phil replies mysteriously.
"By that means you got promotion. Took the business, Phil."
"Yes, Commander. I took the business, such as it was. It wasn't much of a beat round Saffron Hill, Hatton Garden, Clerkenwell, Smithfield, and there. Poor neighbourhood, where they uses up the kettles till they're past mending. Most of the tramping tinkers used to come and lodge at our place. That was the best part of my master's earnings. But they didn't come to me. I weren't like him. He could sing 'em a good song. I couldn't. He could play 'em a tune on any sort of pot you please, so as it was iron or block tin. I never could do nothing with a pot but mend it or bile it. Never had a note of music in me. Besides, I was too ill-looking, and their wives complained of me.
They were mighty particular. You would pass muster in a crowd, Phil, says the trooper with a pleasant smile.
No, Governor, returns Phil, shaking his head. No, I shouldn't. I was passable enough when I went with the tinker, though nothing to boast of then. But what with blowing the fire with my mouth when I was young, and spoiling my complexion, and singeing my hair off, and swallowing the smoke, and what with being naturally unfortunate in the way of running against hot metal and marking myself by such means, and what with having turn-ups with the tinker as I got older, almost whenever he was too far gone in drink, which was almost always, my beauty was queer, very queer, even at that time. As to since, what with a dozen years in a dark forge, where the men was given to larking, and what with being scorched in an accident at a gas-works, and what with being blowed out of window case-filling at the firework business, I'm ugly enough to be made a show on.
Resigning himself to which condition, with a perfectly satisfied manner, Phil begs the favour of another cup of coffee. While drinking it, he says,
"It was after the case-filling blow-up when I first see you, Commander. You remember?"
"I remember, Phil. You were walking along in the sun."
"Crawling, Governor, against a wall."
"True, Phil. Shouldering your way on."
"In a nightcap," exclaims Phil, excited.
"In a nightcap."
"And hobbling with a couple of sticks," cries Phil, still more excited.
"With a couple of sticks, when—"
"When you stops, you know,"
cries Phil, putting down his cup and saucer, and hastily removing his plate from his knees,
"and says to me, 'What, comrade, you've been in the wars?' I didn't say much to you, Commander, then, for I was took by surprise that a person so strong and healthy and bold as you was should stop to speak to such a limping bag of bones as I was. But you says to me, says you, delivering it out of your chest as hearty as possible, so that it was like a glass of something hot, 'What accident have you met with? You've been badly hurt. What's amiss, old boy? Cheer up and tell us about it.' Cheer up? I was cheered already. I says as much to you. You says more to me. I says more to you. You says more to me. And here I am, Commander. Here I am, Commander," cries Phil,
who has started from his chair and unaccountably begun to sidle away.
"If a mark's wanted, or if it will improve the business, let the customers take aim at me. They can't spoil my beauty. I'm all right. Come on, if they want a man to box at, let 'em box at me. Let 'em knock me well about the head. I don't mind. If they want a lightweight to be thrown for practice, Cornwall, Devonshire or Lancashire, let them throw me. They won't hurt me. I have been throwed all sorts of styles all my life."
With this unexpected speech, energetically delivered and accompanied by action illustrative of the various exercises referred to, Phil Squad shoulders his way round three sides of the gallery and, abruptly tacking off at his commander, makes a butt at him with his head, intended to express devotion to his service. He then begins to clear away the breakfast. Mr. George, after laughing cheerfully and clapping him on the shoulder, assists in these arrangements and helps to get the gallery into business order. That done, he takes a turn at the dumbbells, and afterwards, weighing himself and opining that he is getting too fleshy, engages with great gravity in solitary broadsword practice. Meanwhile, Phil has fallen to work at his usual table, where he screws and unscrews, cleans and files and whistles into small apertures, and blackens himself more and more, and seems to do and undo everything that can be done and undone about a gun. Master and man are at length disturbed by footsteps in the passage, where they make an unusual sound, denoting the arrival of unusual company. These steps, advancing nearer and nearer to the gallery, bring into it a group at first sight scarcely reconcilable with any day in the year but the 5th of November. It consists of a limp and ugly figure carried in a chair by two bearers, and attended by a lean female with a face like a pinched mask, who might be expected immediately to recite the popular verses commemorative of the time when they did contrive to blow Old England up alive, but for her keeping her lips tightly and defiantly closed as the chair is put down. At which point the figure in it, gasping,
"Oh, Lord! Oh, dear me, I'm shaken," adds, "How-de-do, my dear friend, how-de-do?"
Mr. George then descries in the procession the venerable Mr. Smallweed out for an airing, attended by his granddaughter Judy as bodyguard.
"Mr. George, my dear friend,"
says Grandfather Smallweed, removing his right arm from the neck of one of his bearers, whom he has nearly throttled coming along.
"How do you do? You're surprised to see me, my dear friend."
"I should hardly have been more surprised to have seen your friend in the city," returns Mr. George.
"I'm very seldom out," pants Mr. Smallweed. "I haven't been out for many months. It's inconvenient, and it comes expensive. But I longed so much to see you, my dear Mr. George. Howdy do, sir?"
"I'm well enough," says Mr. George. "Hope you are the same."
"You can't be too well, my dear friend." Mr. Smallweed takes him by both hands. "I have brought my granddaughter Judy. I couldn't keep her away. She longed so much to see you."
"She bears it calmly," mutters Mr. George.
"So we got a hackney cab and put a chair in it, and just round the corner they lifted me out of the cab and into the chair, and carried me here that I might see my dear friend in his own establishment. This," says Grandfather Smallweed, alluding to the bearer, who has been in danger of strangulation and who withdraws, adjusting his windpipe, "is the driver of the cab."
"He has nothing extra."
"It is, by agreement, included in his fare. This person," the other bearer, "we engaged in the street outside for a pint of beer, which is tuppence. Judy, give the person tuppence. I was not sure you had a workman of your own here, my dear friend, or we needn't have employed this person."
Grandfather Smallweed refers to Phil with a glance of considerable terror and a half-subdued, "Oh, Lord, oh, dear me!" Nor in his apprehension on the surface of things without some reason, for Phil, who has never beheld the apparition in the black velvet cap before, has stopped short with a gun in his hand with much of the air of a dead shot, intent on picking Mr. Smallweed off as an ugly old bird of the crow species.
"Judy, my child," says Grandfather Smallweed, "give the person his tuppence. It's a great deal for what he has done."
The person, who is one of those extraordinary specimens of human fungus that spring up spontaneously in the western streets of London, ready dressed in an old red jacket with a mission for holding horses and corning coaches, received his tuppence with anything but transport, tosses the money into the air, catches it overhanded, and retires.
"My dear Mr. George," says Grandfather Smallweed, "would you be so kind as help to carry me to the fire? I am accustomed to a fire, and I am an old man, and I soon chill. Oh, dear me!"
His closing exclamation is jerked out of the venerable gentleman by the suddenness with which Mr. Squad, like a genie, catches him up, chair and all, and deposits him on the hearthstone.
"Oh, Lord!" says Mr. Smallweed, panting. "Oh, dear me! Oh, my stars! Oh, my dear friend, your workman is very strong and very prompt. Oh, Lord, he is very prompt! Judy, draw me back a little, I'm being scorched in the legs."
Which indeed is testified to the noses of all present by the smell of his worsted stockings. The gentle Judy, having backed her grandfather a little way from the fire, and having shaken him up as usual, and having released his overshadowed eye from its black velvet extinguisher, Mr. Smallweed again says, "Oh, dear me! Oh, Lord!" and looking about and meeting Mr. George's glance, again stretches out both hands.
"My dear friend, so happy in this meeting, and this is your establishment. It's a delightful place. It's a picture. You never find that anything goes off here accidentally, do you, my dear friend?"
adds Grandfather Smallweed, very ill at ease.
"No, no, no fear of that."
"And your workman, he never lets anything off without meaning it, does he, my dear friend?"
"He has never hurt anybody but himself,"
says Mr. George, smiling.
"But he might, you know. He seems to have hurt himself a good deal, and he might hurt somebody else,"
the old gentleman returns.
"He mightn't mean it, or he even might. Mr. George, will you order him to leave his infernal firearms alone and go away?"
Obedient to a nod from the trooper, Phil retires, empty-handed, to the other end of the gallery. Mr. Smallweed, reassured, falls to rubbing his legs.
"And you're doing well, Mr. George," he says to the trooper,
squarely standing faced about towards him with his broadsword in his hand.
"You are prospering, please the powers."
Mr. George answers with a cool nod, adding,
"Go on. You've not come to say that, I know."
"You are so sprightly, Mr. George," returns the venerable grandfather. "You are such good company."
"Ha, ha! Go on," says Mr. George.
"My dear friend, that sword looks awful gleaming and sharp. It might cut somebody by accident. It makes me shiver, Mr. George." "Curse him," says the excellent old gentleman apart to Judy, as the trooper takes a step or two away to lay it aside. "He owes me money, and might think of paying off old scores in this murdering place. I wish your brimstone grandmother was here, and he'd shave her head off." Mr. George, returning, folds his arms, and looking down at the old man, sliding every moment lower and lower in his chair, says quietly,
"Ah, for it!"
"Oh!" cries Mr. Smallweed, rubbing his hands with an artful chuckle. "Yes, now for it. Now for what, my dear friend?"
"For a pipe,"
says Mr. George, who with great composure sets his chair in the chimney corner, takes his pipe from the grate, fills it and lights it, and falls to smoking peacefully. This tends to the discomfiture of Mr. Smallweed, who finds it so difficult to resume his object, whatever it may be,